1956.
1956.
About criticism of Bradley, produced by Fuller. I was talking of Benning. Bradley was a major there. And very competent and very quiet. Incidentally, Collins was a captain, an instructor. Smith, I brought in to be assistant executive officer, though I'd never known him before. And as I said, Vinegar Joe Stillwell was leading tactical instructor. And there were many, many others. But Bradley was conspicuous for his ability to handle people and his ability to see things very simply and clearly. I was trying to get the weapons section straightened out beyond the mere shooting of the guns. For one thing, for example, they were obsessed with the idea of machine gun barrages. With the 30 caliber weapon. And they wished to practically equip the companies with a great deal of the communication setup of a battery of artillery. And I was opposed to this. Not that I knew much about the details, but that I was certain that it was not a good thing to load down an infantry company with so much equipment. I transferred Bradley to the leadership of this weapons section and told him to take a close look at this machine gun situation. After about 2 weeks, I think, he asked me to come out in the field with him and to see demonstrated the fact that the companies already had enough equipment to do the entire thing, but it wasn't being used. It wasn't being utilized to its proper purpose. A calculation that had required, as I dimly recall, several hours. Bradley had cut down to 6 minutes. There were many other things of the same nature that he attended to. And I might say here that the general supply system of the Army for regiments, battalions, divisions, grew out of demonstrations at Benning under the leadership of Bull. The manner of the development is rather interesting. We had little to guide us, and a demonstration of supply took 3 days in the field. The pamphlet on supply was on a mimeograph basis. Benning didn't have the equipment to print anything until I got it out of our own funds from our bookshop. And this pamphlet was 120 pages of mimeographed, single-spaced typing. I informed them that they would have to cut that down, that the way it was set up now would indicate that only a trained regular could ever handle supply. Certainly, only a trained regular in the early part of the war, and I doubt if he'd understand it. After about a year, I found they had reduced this 120 pages to 90 odd. And when I sent word that this must be cut down, the head of the editorial section, Colonel Fletcher, Major Fletcher, came to me and said this couldn't be cut down any further, it had to be rewritten. So I sent word to cut this down to 12 pages. And I think I prescribed they should be double-spaced. Though I'm not certain about this. Anyway, the two instructors, one of whom became a great battle leader later, resigned, or tried to resign. And I composed them a little bit by telling them I didn't admire them as editors at all, and they hadn't written this in the first place. But they were very much worked up over it. One of them was Huebner, who afterwards commanded our troops in Europe. Yeah. And I'd known as a lieutenant in the 1st Division in France, in dugouts and trenches, etc. And I had a great fondness for and admiration for, particularly as to his fighting qualities. So I changed the setup and the control of this supply business and gave it to Bull and told him to demonstrate this as a mobile supply problem, not a setup affair, and to do it as quickly as possible. Bull had paid no attention to supply and was very emphatic in telling me that. I told him to go ahead. And I must say, I gave him no ideas at all, except time limits. I might say I was working on the proposition that we had to hurriedly train an army. And if we couldn't be concise and brief, there was no hope in the manuals. So Bull went at this thing, and he was to make this set up this demonstration. As I recall, he finally succeeded in getting this thing on the basis of a day and a half. And as I absolutely recall, as I perfectly recall, he later on cut this down to a half day. And that was the supply basis for our army. His development.
That's very interesting.
Now in all this, I must say that in a sense, I had no part. I merely furnished the directives and the drive and the arbitrary orders that must be done. From being the most unpopular course in the school, it became one of the most popular. The only trouble was they were always afraid the man who wrote the 122-page mimeographed affair would learn about it, because he was filling a leading position at Leavenworth.
Oh.
I might say that the battalion command at Leavenworth there in some of the problems was several pages long. And I turned our battalion solutions into about a third of a page. And later learned, to my delight and to the great influence of the instructors, that the Germans were giving division orders orally. This is entirely confidential. I had a terrible time getting instructors to simplify these things, because they'd had this elaborate Leavenworth training, which was really based on a static war. I was familiar with the static war. I had gone through one. But we weren't training for that sort of a fight. But this particular procedure, which Bull had charged, had very phenomenal results. I might say that during all this, I had many visitors, and they often wanted to write up these things, particularly Johnson Haygood. And I had to use pressure to see that they wrote about nothing, because I knew I'd be suppressed by the War Department in Leavenworth. But I was assisted by a very brilliant group of young instructors. Stillwell, Bradley, Collins, Bull, and a number of others.
Lenham was there part of that time. Lenham was there, wasn't
he? Yes, he was. There was a student, I think. I used to have these fellows come to my house. I was a bachelor or widower at the time. And we would have an evening of discussions with various ones taking the lead. These were very interesting and very helpful, very illuminating. I noticed shortly after the war that General Collins wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post about his services in the Southwest Pacific and Guadalcanal and in Europe, the surrender of Brest, etc. And he made reference to these meetings as being the most uplifting, though he didn't use that word, in his army career.
Then you would say this is one of the most profitable parts of your own career, one of the most important from the standpoint of the wartime army.
Oh, my, yes. I was left there for 5 years. Which gave me time to make changes without doing it with violence. They had developed a very effective system of instruction. Extraordinarily so. And they'd followed the best recommendations on what is the word for teaching? Pedagogy.
Yes.
Of the day. A professor from the University of Wisconsin, who is a leader in this field, visited Benning and thought the procedure there was more advanced than anywhere in the United States. Of course, you could do that there because the faculty was young, and if the individual was reluctant, it was very easy to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
This occurred before my time. I was interested in brevity. The instructor used to read his lecture, and it had to be sent to the editorial section about a month in advance to make certain that it didn't contravene any of the agreed policies. I finally forbade any reading and allowed them to have a card to note down the principal factors. But when I heard an instructor one day say, I'm required this morning to discuss and then look down at his card to see what is discussed, which of course was merely a nervous gesture, I suppressed the card too. Because I found it was many times more effective when a man talked off the cuff, as it were, though it was a very well ironed cuff. I also revoked one of the binding rules of the school, that when you finished, you stopped, and you didn't prolong the session till the end of the hour. That was enthusiastically received by the students. And strange to say, opposed by all the instructors. I had a very amusing experience in my effort to have them brief their presentations, make them more incisive. So I quoted from a story where a little girl is writing to her guardian and describing what she had just had in it's part of the English thing, what do you call it?
Grammar or composition?
Well, it had to do with composition. There's a term for the whole thing.
Rhetoric?
Hmm?
Rhetoric?
Rhetoric. And she writes a very amusing letter to her guardian after the style indicated in rhetoric. Numbered 1 to 5, which exactly equaled our field order distribution. And I read this to them, and it proved highly amusing. And they spent several weeks trying to find out where I got it. And they finally traced me to the library in Columbus and discovered that this was Daddy Long Legs.
Oh.
Of Mary Pickford fame. Matter of fact, I had to use every device I could think of to carry my point, because it doesn't do to just issue a ukase, if that is the word, regarding such matters. They've all got to believe them. So Daddy Long Legs won the day.
Have you just run across it and reading it?
I remembered it, and I went back and looked it up. As funny as the deuce, you ought to go look at it. It's as funny as the deuce.
That'll make a beautiful little story in a book, you see. It lightens it, but it gets the point across. I'll look it up.
Daddy Longlegs. It's a very short thing. You can look at it. It's a very charming little story, you know. We better get down to business here.
Well, this, though, is business. It's not these particular questions, but I'm delighted when you... There are a lot of these things I don't know enough about to ask you about, you see. Someday I'll say, well, let's talk about Benning, but you may not think of all of them then. So I'm delighted if when one of these hits your mind, you'll go into it, because I have a feeling that some of the most fascinating part of the book for service people is going to be this part.
I've said several times, this puts me in a very embarrassing position of seeming to be the one who knew. Well, as a matter of fact, throughout all of this, I'm largely recording my reactions to the experiences of the AEF and the later training in the Army while I was a general person, and my own experiences in these schools. Question 10, I don't recall. Except that the President was getting very cautious about getting our troops involved in distant fields. Question 11, I don't know. That's keeping. I know that Mr. Stimson was very much pleased with my letter to Eisenhower because Patton had been his aide.
Oh.
And he was much distressed at the hole Patton had gotten himself into. I might say that I heard Mrs. Marshall say to Patton, when Patton was a colonel, "George, you mustn't talk like that. You say these outrageous things, then you look at me to see if I'm going to smile." Now, you could do that as a captain or a major, but you aspire to be a general, and a general cannot talk in any such wild way. He just laughed at her, and that is the end of it, but she hit the nail on the head. Turn that off.
Yeah.
At the time, we were having discussions with Mr. Churchill here in Washington about sending troops to Cairo at the moment of the British distress there, or Alexandria. I was vigorously opposed to sending troops, but very much in favor of sending tanks. And incidentally, it was very embarrassing to me because when we sent them, we had to take them away from the divisions that had never had the new tanks before and had only had these for 2 weeks. And yet we couldn't explain why we were doing it, and received rather heavy lambasting for our inconsistencies of our staff procedure. So these tanks were sent, and then a whole lot of them were lost, but the vessel sank, and we had to go and skin the rest away from the troops. So that they had none left at all. Well, I brought Patton on and sent him down to War College to make the plans for moving a division into this thing, not hoping against hope that I wouldn't have to do it, but feeling I should be prepared to do it in case the President ordered the move. I told Patton when he came that we were all opposed to this, but I felt it was necessary to make the plans. I said there'd been big discussion about it, particularly as to what we would send. And the decision is final, that it'd be a division and about eight a total of 18,000 troops. The division then was about 12,000. But that's all the special troops we could send. That there'd be no question of sending another division, make it a corps. And I didn't want that brought up at all. I didn't want to hear from one. That was settled. And so he'd get down to the War College and get to work on the thing. He went down to the War College, and to my intense surprise, early the next morning, I got a letter from Patton vigorously proposing sending an additional division. So I sent one of the secretaries of the General Staff to get General Patton, put him on a plane, and send him back to California that morning, which they did. Scared him off the bat.
November 20th, interview with General Marshall.
Ready?
Yes, sir.
This is chapter 17, question 1. What was the background of your SET proposal? I just don't recall at the present time. Question 2. Did you feel that the Bay of Biscay operation was practical?
That's the one he tried to get you to do right at the last.
Yeah. We did not. Added to which, we knew it would take us a long, long time to clear the harbors, as it proved later on. We had a very difficult time clearing the harbor in the north. What harbor is that?
Cherbourg.
Yes. Question 2, or question 3. There are two phases to this question. One of the heading off the Russians. The other, the interest in the big victory in Italy under British command. I don't think it was a question of a big victory in Italy under British command. It is a question of operating in that region and extending it up towards Vienna. I might interject a rather trivial action regarding the Ljubljana Gap. I, of course, was intimately familiar with this from map studies. But it's a little difficult to get the complete picture. When I was flying over for the preliminary Malta conference, I wanted to see Eisenhower and he was coming down from his headquarters to see me. The fighting around the Bulge was still in progress, though going favorably to us now. The weather was atrocious, and Eisenhower came down by his private car. With Buell, the liaison official in that region, American, had taken a villa outside of Marseille. Incidentally, it was owned by the sister of the famous Rostang, I think, stage.
Maurice Rostang.
Impresario. Our man was a Polish stock, and was a duplicate of Hindenburg.
Oh.
His servants or soldier assistants, he picked up largely in northern Italy. I wanted a haircut, so they sent the barber to my bathroom, but they sent with him the head butler, I suppose you would call him, to do the translating. While they were cutting my hair, I inquired of the barber, where was he from? Well, he was from the crest of the Ljubljana Gap.
Oh.
So I devoted the conversation from then on to descriptions of the country, which are going to be very helpful to me. Then the translator, or the chief butler, disagreed with my barber, and he, it seems, was at the foot of the gap. So we spent about an hour and a half, they spent about an hour and a half, educating me as to the country.
An unusual briefing, wasn't it?
It was. And later, when we got into discussions with the British chiefs of staff, they were astonished at my knowledge of the Ljubljana Gap. One of them, I think, said that you must have spent the summer there. But I didn't tell him it was the barber.
While we're on that, I couldn't get much information on that meeting between you and General Eisenhower, except that in Butcher's diary, he says that at one point you told Eisenhower if they didn't back you up, if you were he, you'd just quit.
If they didn't back me up?
They didn't back him up on that, on his campaign.
Yeah, that I would quit.
In other words, if you were in his place, if you were in Eisenhower's place, you'd quit if they didn't back you up.
I don't recall
on that. But this was something that someone had told him. Butcher was not down there.
Oh, I see.
And
well,
he just put out some gossip.
I don't recall that.
But you talked about the campaign up there in the north and the coming.
That's what he was down there for. However, most of the conversation went to the fact that he wanted the Mountain Division, which had just been given to Clark. And he, Eisenhower, were seeking reinforcements. And I wouldn't do it. I said, and he was stressing the importance of his situation. I said, we asked you if you wanted that division, and you said no. That its organization didn't suit your purposes. We asked Clark, he wanted it, and he cabled yes within about an hour, and is making magnificent use of it. And Eisenhower said, I said no. And I said, yes, you said no. And now you want to turn around and take it away from Clark, who said, yes, I won't give it to you. And he said, Bull, how about that? Bull flushed up to the top of his ear and admitted that they had said no because they didn't quite like its organization.
He didn't know it. Eisenhower had done
it. He didn't know it, no. He was very much taken back. Bull was very much embarrassed.
That had an interesting history, that mountain division, didn't
it? Oh, yes.
It
did a gorgeous job down there in Italy. I'll tell you later about that campaign. It was all the finals of that campaign were extraordinarily interesting. You started to ask me a question.
Oh, you planned it to be used somewhere else, didn't you?
Planned it to use in the Neptune operation and drop it on the glacier in the
Norway.
And finally, we wiped out the heavy water plant by an operation along the shore. Question four is whether or not I drafted his message to Churchill. I haven't any idea. As I told you, many of his messages to Churchill, he didn't show us.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally got them through Dill.
Mm-hmm.
This might have been fixed up there by me and my staff, but I have no recollection of what the circumstances were. Question five, I don't recall their bringing that up. Question six. What generally were your relations with the Prime Minister in these questions? Did he talk to you much, or had he decided that it was better to work with someone else? He would talk to me very frankly and very persuasively. And then when he couldn't turn me, he possibly did turn to someone else. In these conferences, almost invariably, when I arrived, Mr. Churchill had arrived. And I think invariably, he invited me to dinner with him alone the first night. At Casablanca, it was lunch. But at all the other places, it was at night. I don't remember Tehran. I remember most clearly Egypt. We sat and talked from about 8 o'clock until 3 in the morning. There's when he would put his arguments up to me. They were very charming talks as a rule because he would be most discursive before we got down to the real business that he had in mind. Might interject a couple of examples. At Cairo, He'd taken the house of the British Consul General there, or head of the commission there, of Australia. And we first sat out in a courtyard where there's a fountain, then went into dinner, and then continued on to the early morning hours. I had been reading on the plane one of the books in my plane library. I think they're called One Man's. One of those little well-known books, I've forgotten, One Man's Library or something of that sort.
Every Man.
Every Man's Library. I'd been reading about I've forgotten in a moment, of course it'll come back. And this is the subject of many of our debates and discussions. Who is the Jew Prime Minister of England?
Disraeli. Lord Beaconsfield or Disraeli? Disraeli. Is it one of his books?
Well, it is a relation to him, I think. It doesn't ring quite clear in my mind. Anyway, in this particular thing, and I'll give you the name later, I was commenting about this thing that I'd just been reading in One Man's Library, every Man's Library. And Churchill picked this up and he quoted whole speeches made before Parliament, word for word, got very intense about it and got up and strode around the room and making these quotes. It's a famous parliamentary incident in their British history. I should have the man's name on the tip of my tongue. The moment I can only think of Disraeli, but yet I don't believe he's the one. Or Pitt. Well, I think it was Pitt.
Oh, Pitt.
It was Pitt. And it is quite amazing the way Mr. Churchill could photograph this stuff. On the plane, he and I were flying over to Algiers with Brooke. I was trying to keep him from bringing up the subject of the Washington Conference. Well, all during the early part of the trip, he was so busy with his own state papers, which he'd gotten far behind, the hazard of such a conversation didn't arise. But as we were approaching Gibraltar, Mr. Churchill ran out of work and came back and sat down with me. And then I knew I was in for it. And the point was, I didn't wish to talk to him till I'd had a chance to talk to Eisenhower. The background were Mediterranean operations. What was that island out in the Mediterranean that we never went to?
Rhodes.
Rhodes, Sicily, and so forth. Rhodes, Sicily, Sardinia, the southern tip of Italy.
And Corsica. Corsica.
Yeah, of course. So I hurriedly thought up something to talk about. And I asked the Prime Minister about told him I had been reading Indian history. Not exactly refreshing my mind, because my early reading had been from a very immature standpoint. I now was trying to dig out the innards of it, because I was having so many concerns with officers in India in relation to Burma and China. And Lord Halifax had loaned me his copy of a very complete account of the famous, who was the head fellow in India that they...
Clive?
Hmm?
Clive?
No, he was the fighting fellow. I mean, the it lasted 10 or 11 years, this attack on him.
Well, Hastings.
Warren Hastings.
Hastings. Great trial.
I talked to him about that and asked him if the fact that this thing ran for 11 years and then ended in, you might say, no count, had changed any of the procedure in Parliament, rules of procedure in Parliament. And he told me it had not. Then he gave me the most astonishing resume of such matters, and I remember he got over with Louis XI in France and went on up into Great Britain in his various procedures regarding this affair. Two things are involved. What is Warren Hastings was? What are they trying to?
One of them was he'd taken money
no,
away.
No, what he did, but what they call the thing?
Impeachment.
The impeachment of Warren Hastings, and he contrasted that with a bill of attainder, and gave me a perfectly remarkable historical discussion of these two factors. I tried to remember them so that I could appear well educated on occasion, but there were so many tricks to it that I couldn't do it. But he suddenly ran out of soap after about 20 minutes of this, and I'd been so fascinated that I hadn't thought up what my next deterrent would be. So I asked him about the famous parachute drop of Hitler's number two man in Scotland.
Hess.
Hess. Rudolf Hess, on the Duke of Hamilton, I think, his estate. Well, again, he opened up in the most fascinating way. Of course, he, of course, was a party to this. They were trying to turn British favor against Churchill and over to the side of opposing the continuation of the war. And there's a great deal of interest about the Duke of Hamilton. And I know Brooke had never heard this, and he was fascinated. And I, again, was overly fascinated, and he got to the end of that. That was about 15 minutes. And there we were finished again, and I didn't have a new subject. And I knew as certain as fate before dinner this thing would come. So I just made a desperate grab, and in a most impolitic way, I said, well, now, as I recall from the press accounts, you were said to be a leader of the King's party in the great question of his abdication and his marriage to Mrs. What's her name?
Simpson.
Well, he took that right up without hesitation and gave me a most interesting account of it, out of which I remember the one thing that the great mistake the King made was just not going ahead and marrying her. So the King could do no wrong. He could marry her, and then they could scratch around and try to settle this thing. But he talked this time for about 20 minutes. And it was a marvelous lecture. Just marvelous. And then the steward, thank God, announced supper, dinner. And it was all over. But I've never heard three more fascinating accounts than he gave on that particular occasion, any one of which could have been printed and sold to a magazine for a large amount of money. But I think the most interesting one was the discussion of the Bill of Attainder and the impeachment and the history of the whole development of such things.
Macaulay wrote a long account of that trial of Warren Hastings. It's one of the great classics of English history.
Yes, I'd read it in those...
That's the one you'd read. It was in Halifax's Cup.
I know in relation to these books, Dill was very tired in Washington, and he suggested that we fly over to Bermuda. It's only about a 3 hours flight. And of course you get a plane. And he communicated to the Governor General, and we had an invitation, of course, to stay at Government House. And we flew over. Had a perfectly delightful visit. And I didn't know anything about these people. I was charmed with the wife, Lady Burley, who's and went back there afterwards. And so we spent a delightful two days or 3 days there. I've forgotten this one. I know she and I got out there counting redbirds, and I never saw so many redbirds in my life. I brought them the music of Oklahoma, and they were very much taken with a surrey with a fringe around the top, because they had one out there with a fringe around the top. However, going back on the plane to the United States, I was reading my Every Man's Library. And I came across the discussion of Lord Burleigh's progenitor, who had been Prime Minister under Queen Elizabeth, good Queen Bess, for almost 60 years. And as a matter of fact, had assisted her in the decision for the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, who's Lady Burleigh's direct ancestor, great-great-great-great-grandmother, or something like that. Well, I was chiding Dill. We'd gone there and stayed. He didn't know a thing about this. I didn't know a thing about it. We learned it all on the plane going back, so I had to read the book to him as we came back to the United States, which I thought was rather funny.
But it astounds me to find that you read all these things in the middle of the war.
How do you mean?
Well, that you had time for it.
I was on the plane.
Uh-huh. But so many people wouldn't have thought of getting into that stuff on India and all that.
Well, India was business.
Mm-hmm.
My knowledge of India, see, was, you might say, a boy's knowledge of India. I hadn't read these things with discretion and penetration. Now I needed to know. Mm-hmm. And in doing this, I ran into the business of Warren Hastings, and then I had this thought when I was prolonging the conversation with Churchill. Here's a good one.
Incidentally, had you read as a boy or a young man G.A. Hinty's books, you know,
all
he wrote about
I
India?
I read all of them. I know Hamilcar and Hannibal and all those people much better from Hinty than I do from anybody else.
I've actually talked about Hamilcar from that book because it's magnificent.
I found that it's so much easier to understand the things from his books. And I read them all. I remember those two in particular. Mm-hmm. And...
he had one on India that gave me my first picture
I think
of the mutiny.
I think I read that. Well, I thought Hendy was an accomplished historian.
He was.
But he had the great ability to picture the thing so that you wanted to read it. You could take boys through history with that right off the bat because they all liked it. I don't remember how many Hendy books I read, but I read first Hamilcar and then I read Hannibal. And that's my complete memory of Hannibal. Question 7. I get the impression that one time you felt General Eisenhower might be wavering on Anvil and that you had to keep him firm. I don't recall. Question 8. Did you have the impression that the British Chiefs of Staff were less set on stopping Anvil And the Prime Minister, yes. Now, Triumph and Tragedy says this. I don't agree with the Prime Minister on the anvil question at all. In fact, I'm almost in complete disagreement on every phase of it. He was intent on one thing, and he sways all his arguments to justify that one thing. As I told you, there was a paper of data that they prepared for me, and I couldn't use it because of the way it is written, the castigation of anvil. Almost everything he said to deter us from that operation down there went exactly the other way with a tremendous success. We had very hard fighting on the right in the Vosges Mountains at the end.
Yeah.
And notably on the capture of that town down there where they had to go up the walls like in the old fashioned. The 3rd Infantry had such, 3rd Division had such heavy losses. It's a large town down this on the southern front of the Vosges, I've forgotten the name of it.
That's not Colmar.
Colmar. We had very heavy fighting there, all of which deeply concerned Eisenhower's procedures. If you take the commander, say Alexander, in that place, of course he wants it there. MacArthur was just as much opposed to Anvil as Alexander was, for the same reason. He wanted the things his way out there where he was. If you followed every commander, you'd just be lost. We'd be sunk. We'd be all over the place. My hardest function was trying to keep to the things that we could do. I had an example of that. It goes into everything, practically, in a governmental way. I had an example of that when we were trying to get straightened up on the European recovery program. As I've often said, it wasn't the idea of the so-called Marshall Plan. That wasn't so much that as it was the execution and how we got it through Congress. And it took us from June until the following April. And I worked on that as hard as though I was running for the Senate or the presidency. And that's what I'm proud of, that part of it. Because I had farmers, I had tobacco people, cotton people, New York, and Eastern industrialists, and Pittsburgh people, the whole West Coast going in the other direction, up in the Northwest. And it was just a struggle from start to finish. And that's what I'm proud of, that we actually did that and put it over. I remember some amusement one day they came in to see me and said, wanted me to see some farmers. I thought they were talking about half a dozen maybe from Ohio. And I said, I haven't got time for that sort of thing now. Well, they said, they've just come from Mr. Taft. Well, I said, that farmers are very much involved in this because it affected their farm machinery and all the things they were in short supply of, fertilizers particularly. So I walked into the room and I found there were almost 60. And they just had lunch with Mr. Taft. I sat down at the end of the table and asked them who was the head fella, and they told me that. I asked them what they were there for, and they told me that. And I talked for about 40 minutes and then got up and left. And they remained in the room and reversed themselves on Mr. Taft.
I knew you were active then, but I never realized you did that much.
Oh, Lord, I traveled all over the country. I'll tell you later about the West Coast thing, because that's really almost dramatic. I did tell you about going out to the Federation of Women's Clubs.
Yes.
Out there when I wasn't going to things in general. I remember the farmers had a meeting up at Des Moines. I almost lost my life in that because I got forced down on the only airport that was available, and 15 minutes later, before I got to the house, a downpour occurred, which did, they said, $10 million of damage in Chattanooga. And they got me a clear wire through to the convention, and I talked to them over this wire with a loudspeaker. I had quite a time down in Atlanta with the tobacco growers and the cotton growers, and of course they wanted fertilizer very badly, and were very strong organizations, and I got them when I got through with my talk there, but I had a very hard time doing it. Then I went down the West Coast. That was the most interesting and amusing trip, and starting with the University of California, Berkeley, and going down to the University of California, Los Angeles, and I came out of that successfully. But I had to just travel all the time. Pittsburgh was a very difficult thing. I had friends there, and they were all nice and listened to me, but wholly and completely unsympathetic. I talked to the Association of Manufacturers up in New York. They gave me a very large luncheon, and I had to get them. It was a very hard thing to do. They were always very nice to me there, though. I don't know where all else I talked. I think Philadelphia. There were a number of other places that I don't recall. But that was a hard fight.
Oh, it was.
And that was the thing that I took some pride in. Matter of fact, the selection of the time and the place was largely done on the basis of what the opposition would be, because all America was opposed to appropriating anything else, because the way the first appropriation right after the war had been wasted. And we had Burt McCormick leading the attack out in the Middle West and putting on a very heavy barrage. I remember Vandenberg said to me, "You need to belittle this." He said, "I have to sit up and be called a Benedict Arnold."
You mentioned being forced down there, I mean, landing. Did you have any narrow escapes other than that during your time during the war?
Yes, I had. It's peculiar, I had most of them near here. I'd get clear around the world and then get in trouble up there at Washington trying to get in. I'd come in and this whole coast would be under fog. Flying this case where this I got came down to this plane the last.